Hello, and welcome to another episode of Robbinsdale Revisited. Today we're here with Pete Ritchie, president of the Robbinsdale Historical Society, talking about a very unique aspect of the city. Before Robbinsdale ever knew it was a wrestling town, it was just a town full of kids. Kids in backyards on playgrounds, rolling around in the grass, practicing headlocks they barely understood, leaping off picnic tables and calling it a flying elbow. Someone always played the bad guy. Someone always won the belt. And somehow, everyone knew wrestling mattered, even if they didn't quite know why. Part of that reason was Robbinsdale High School. For decades, it ran one of the toughest wrestling programs in the state. Practices were hard, the expectations were high, and quitting wasn't really an option. The goal wasn't fame, it was grit, discipline, and surviving another day on the mat. As it turns out, that's also excellent preparation for professional wrestling. The story starts with Vern Gagne, a Robbinsdale High School standout who won two state championships in the 1940s. Gagne didn't just become a star, he founded the American Wrestling Association, turning Minnesota into an unlikely wrestling capital and giving local kids a hero who felt close to home. And the pipeline just kept going. Larry the Axe Hennig became a state champion and a global wrestling menace. His son, Kurt Mr. Perfect Hennig, grew up watching it all and somehow became exactly that, perfect. Ravishing Rick Rude brought swagger and sneer. Barry Darso proved that a Robbinsdale kid could grow up to wear face paint, spikes, and rule Saturday mornings on TV. And the list goes on. Tom Zenk, Brady Boone, John Nord, Nikita Koloff, proof that those backyard matches sometimes led somewhere real. And Deborah Maselli, or Medusa, helped change wrestling history entirely by delivering one of the most unforgettable moments the sport has ever seen. So maybe that's the Robbinsdale wrestling story. A small town, a tough high school, and generations of kids pretending to be their heroes, some of whom grew up to become them. From quiet playgrounds to roaring arenas, Robbinsdale didn't just produce wrestlers. It produced legends and a whole lot of flying elbows.
So one of the most amazing things about Robbinsdale is we have more professional wrestlers per capita than anywhere that I can think of. But they all came from the same high school, and a lot of them graduated the same year. And what probably kicked this off is you have Larry the Axe Hennig, who graduates in the 1950s. Grigelko is his coach, and he becomes Larry the Axe. He ran under a couple other names too, but he had a great wrestling career, and it started back there in the 50s and went all the way through the 70s. He was still wrestling. But his son shows up at Robbinsdale High School in the middle of the 1970s, Kurt Hennig. He's probably better known as Mr. Perfect, and he was a celebrated professional wrestler recognized for his technical brilliance and his athleticism and his unmatched charisma. Hennig grew up in Robbinsdale, and he was immersed in the world of wrestling. By the time he gets to Robbinsdale High School, the school is just a breeding ground for future stars. Hennig's professional wrestling career kicks in the early 80s, and he debuts in the American Wrestling Association. Well, the person in charge of the American Wrestling Association is Vern Gagne. And we talked about him, of course. He mostly lived out in Corcoran, but his coaches loved him so much. He was on the football team, the baseball team. Of course, he was a wrestler. That they put him up at the Robin Hotel. Whenever he hears Robbinsdale, whenever he runs into Larry the Axe Hennig, and when Larry's son, Kurt, comes along, of course, there's just a bond there. They got something to talk about, and that may be why we end up with so many other professional wrestlers. Hennig goes on. He has a great career. He captured the AWA World Tag Team Championship, and his career skyrocketed in 1987 when he defeated Nick Bockwinkel to win the AWA World Heavyweight Championship. Bockwinkel was always on television on Sunday. That's when we watch wrestling. And the promo ad for Bockwinkel is he'd be sitting there with his giant belt and he'd say, "I'm Nick Bockwinkel. Please enjoy the world of wrestling with me and all my cohorts right here on Channel 11, or it could have been Channel 9. I can't even remember. But I remember Nick Bockwinkel's big voice and how he was inviting us all to watch wrestling. And we all did. He was the AWA World Heavyweight Champion for 373 days. You know, he had all these memorable matches against people like Jerry Lawler, and he was the first one, but he certainly wasn't the last, and pretty soon all of his friends started showing up in the AWA. In 1988, though, Hennig joins the WWF, and that's when he becomes Mr. Perfect, and he worked with a lot of guys he grew up with in Robbinsdale in the WWF, too. His match against Bret Hart at SummerSlam in 1991 remains one of the most celebrated intercontinental championship bouts in WWF history. In the 1990s, Hennig transitioned to world championship wrestling, and he was joined in these factions. He participated in this group called the New World Order and the West Texas Rednecks. And so they were just groups of wrestlers, and they would team up into tag teams, and they were all kind of had each other's back. Beyond his professional accolades, the Hennig family remembers him as kind of a family man. Tragically, he passed away in February 10th of 2003. He was only 44 years old. He died of acute cocaine intoxication, and his death was a pretty significant loss to the wrestling world. His legacy endures through his contributions to the industry and the impact he left on fans and fellow wrestlers. He was posthumously inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame by his friend and longtime manager, Bobby the Brain Heenan. And, you know, anybody who watched television in the 70s and 80s remembers Bobby the Brain because he was just gave a great interview. And of course, all the best wrestlers had Bobby the Brain as their manager if they were lucky. The other big personality that comes out of Robbinsdale High School is Richard Irwin Rude. Of course, he's better known as Rick Rude, and he became an iconic professional wrestler because he just had one of the best shticks that I can ever remember. The idea was Rick Rude. He was Ravishing Rick. He was so beautiful. Women just could not help themselves when they saw Ravishing Rick and his mullet and his mustache. They threw themselves at him, and he would come out under the ring, and he would warn the audience, you know, wherever he was. If he was in Philadelphia, he would say, "I need to take a minute and warn all the women in the audience that I'm about to take off my robe. So I know you're sitting there next to your fat, lazy, out-of-shape husbands, and you're not used to seeing something like this." And then he would disrobe, and the crowd would boo because he was usually the bad guy. But he had a great shtick, and it's well remembered. Funny thing is, if you look at pictures of him in high school, he was not a great big guy. But by the time he's a wrestler, he's really worked on that body, and he's done all sorts of weightlifting. So his wrestling journey begins in the mid-80s, where he was quickly made a name for himself, and he was cocky, and he had his flashy robes and his signature swiveling hips. He was a natural heel, and he would often provoke the audience by insulting their hometown or showing off his physique. The Rude Awakening was his signature move. It was kind of a neck breaker. It was a sort of a pre-match tradition. He'd have selecting a woman from the audience to kiss, only to be added to his notoriety. So he would look around and say, "Who's going to get a kiss from Big Rick Rude?" His early highlights included stints in promotions like the NWA, where he was he won the Southern Heavyweight Championship. In 1987, Rude joins the WWF, where he gained significant fame. He's got a feud running with Jake the Snake Roberts and the Ultimate Warrior, and so those are kind of memorable ones. Rude's rivalry with Roberts was fueled by disrespectful antics, such as wearing tights featuring Roberts' wife. So a lot of times Rick Rude would wear these tights, and most of the time his face would appear on the tights somehow. But anyway, he had a tights featuring Roberts' wife, and so that got everybody riled up. So Rude eventually transitions to the WCW, where his career reached new heights. He was aligned in something called the Dangerous Alliance, which was led by Paul E. Dangerously. Rude became the dominant United States heavyweight championship and played a major role in the WCW's most competitive storylines. However, injuries began to plague his career, and during a match against somebody named Sting, but not the rock star, in Japan, Rude suffered a severe back injury, which ultimately led him to retire from active competition in 1994. But despite his retirement, Rude remained involved in wrestling, serving as a manager and occasionally a commentator. Notably, he became a member of the influential D, Generation X faction in the WWF during the 1990s, appearing on both WWF's Raw and WCW's Nitro on the same night in a unique contractual situation. Tragically, Rick Rude passed away on April 20th, 1999 from heart failure. His legacy, however, also endures, known for his charisma, technical ability, ability to captivate audiences. Rude was posthumously inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame in 2017. Rude's career serves as a reminder of the artistry of storytelling and all the things that make professional wrestling such a captivating form of entertainment. We were talking to Ron here at the Historical Society just a couple weeks ago, and of course Ron always remembers when Rick Rude came into Montgomery Ward's and how big he was. Anyway, we'll keep going because that's just two of the many professional wrestlers who graduated in 1976 or 1977 from Robbinsdale High School. So these guys all kind of knew each other. Another one was Thomas Irwin Zink, and Zink was a professional wrestler known as the Z-Man, a charismatic athletic figure in the wrestling world, although he played soccer on the Robbinsdale High School soccer team, not a wrestler in high school. After graduating, he got involved in bodybuilding, and he earned the Mr. Minnesota title. His pal was a guy named Joe who was in this group called the Road Warrior Animal. He recruits them and they transition from bodybuilding to professional wrestling. And he trains under this guy named Eddie Sharkey, who a lot of Robbinsdale people worked with. Zink debuts in 1984 in the Mid-South Wrestling and soon gained recognition in this magazine called the Wrestling Observer Newsletter. He was Rookie of the Year, tying with Jushin Liger. He later joins the Pacific Northwest Wrestling Promotion, where he's captured in the NWA Pacific Northwest Tag Team and Heavyweight Championships in Canada. He teams up with a guy named Dan Crawford to win the Canadian International Tag Team Championship. And Zink gets a mainstream breakthrough in 1986 when he signed with the World Wrestling Federation, partnering with Rick Martel. They formed the popular Can-Am Connection and were poised to become the top contenders. However, Zink abruptly left the WWF in 1987 due to a pay dispute. In 1989, Zink wrestled for the World Championship Wrestling, rebranding as the Z-Man. During his WCW tenure, he held the WCW World Television Championship, NWA United States Tag Team Championship with Brian Pillman, and the WCW World Six-Man Tag Team Championship. He was high energy. He had a real vibrant persona. After leaving the WCW, Zink worked with a Japanese pro wrestling interest and competed on the independent circuit. He retired in 1996. Beyond wrestling, he was known for candid interviews and reflections on the business. Wrestling historians, of which I'm sure there are many, you know, he was always there for an interview. He passed away in 2017 in his hometown of Robbinsdale. He's going to be missed. He did manage to survive the wrestling career, though, which not a lot of these guys did, unfortunately. The other one we should talk about is Nord the Barbarian, John Eric Nord. He's also remembered for these car commercials. I think somebody in his family owned a car business, and he would leap onto the hood and pound the hood of the car and yell at whoever was watching on the TV that they should get down there and buy a car. Played football, and he wrestled at Robbinsdale High School, graduating 1977. Again, he worked with this Eddie Sharkey, and he trained so many of our Minnesota wrestling stars. Nord's early days wrestling saw him developing a persona as a towering, imposing figure, drawing on his, you know, natural size and athleticism, and he created this kind of menacing presence in the ring, sort of a berserker. His first prominent role came with the AWA, which Vern Gagne was running, where he wrestled under the name Nord the Barbarian. And so the character emphasized, you know, brute strength, savagery, untamed demeanor, the berserker Viking. He had a long, rugged beard, and he had a hat with horns and just all the works, usually dressed in animal skins. In his early years, Nord built credibility as a tag team competitor and a singles wrestler. He worked alongside Bruiser Brody in Japan and in other territories too. Nord developed this wild brawler persona that the fans found, you know, chaotic and entertaining. By this time, Nord began to draw from Nordic warrior archetypes, which would later sort of be the foundation of his more iconic roles. He eventually ends up in an organization called the World Class Championship Wrestling, and Nord continues to be a barbarian there, and he's just got a reputation as a powerhouse performer. In the 1980s, Nord adopted a new gimmick in the World Wrestling Federation, again, the Berserker, so new but old. One of his most memorable roles, the Berserker, again, was a Viking-inspired warrior clad in fur and leather, often wielding a shield and sword, just the complete look. And so Nord fully embraced the character's wild nature, frequently shouting, "Huss, huss," a nod to the mentor, Bruiser Brody. So that was his catchphrase. Huss, huss, the Berserker. So he's uncontrollable and he's sometimes winning matches by the count out after throwing opponents out of the ring. And he's often in a feud with this guy called the Undertaker. That kind of helps elevate his presence because nothing is going to help your wrestling career except being a feud with one of the other wrestlers. So after leaving the WWF, Nord joined the World Championship Wrestling under his real name, John Nord. And while he was with the WCW, so there was all sorts of theatrics involved there, just like in his earlier career. And he solidified his reputation as a dependable performer with a rugged brawling style. And then when he retires from professional wrestling, he goes to work for his brother's auto shop, Nord East Motors. So in July 2016, he's named as part of a class action suit that's filed against the WWE. It's alleged that wrestlers suffer traumatic brain injuries, which, of course, we know from football, that would certainly be the case. Nord's been diagnosed with ALS, and that's confined him to a wheelchair. Nord's wrestling legacy, of course, has left a trail of larger-than-life personas, capitalizing on his imposing stature and his ability to embody the Viking-like characters. I don't know if anybody does the Viking character anywhere near as well as he did. Still with us, so that's the good news with John Nord. Long may he reign. Dean Roberts Peters. Little bit lesser known and probably the one that has the goofiest in-ring personas. He was on the Robbinsdale High School gymnastics teams, and he was a bit of an acrobat, but he begins wrestling with the WWF, the WCW, the PNW, which is the Pacific Northwest Wrestling. So early in his career, Boone makes a name for himself out there on the West Coast. And he also had some success as a tag team wrestler, along with Ricky Santana was his tag team partner. He debuts as this character named Brady Boone, and he does okay with that one. But then he comes up with a gimmick where he's going to put on a mask. And if you ever see a picture of him, he's Battle Cat. And Battle Cat, for some reason, looks like a Muppet to me. Big, muscly Muppet. But the Battle Cat mask, I mean, it's got, if Jim Henson was designing a cat mask, it would look a little bit like what Brady Boone would wear if he was out there. So after leaving the WWF, Boone wrestles with the WCW, and tragically, his promising career is pretty much cut short in a car accident, and he dies December 15th in 1998. He was only 40 years old. You know, he was a skilled athlete. He brought some of that gymnastics capability into the ring and would do backflips and leap off the ropes. And so he's mostly remembered for these wild moves. One of the most beloved Robbinsdale wrestlers, because it just never ends. These are all guys, again, who graduate 1976, 77, 78. So they were all at Robbinsdale High School together. And some of them knew each other. Some of them didn't. It was a big school. But Barry Allen Darso, I always remember him as the Repo Man, and he was on the Robbinsdale football and the hockey team. He graduated in 1978, and so he goes to work training with Ed Sharkey again. Sharkey was a former professional wrestler who had competed for the AWA in the 1960s, and he was working as a bartender at Grandma B's in Northeast Minneapolis, along with the bouncers that were keeping an eye on the place. Now, some of the people he hired for bouncers were Rick Rude, of course. So Rick Rude's, 6'3 and 235 pounds. He's going to make a great bouncer. Then he also hires Michael Hagstrand, Barry Darso, and John Nord. And these people all kind of describe Grandma Bee's as not really anything like a typical neighborhood hangout, that it's just always a little bit rowdy, a little bit rowdier than any other place. And so you had to have great bouncers. So Sharkey goes into the professional wrestling business in 1982, and he recruits his bouncers as, sort of his first talents. And they set up a little training school in a church basement. And there he coaches, Rick Rude and Hagstrand and Darso, and transforms them into professional wrestlers. So as a professional wrestler, Darso is best known for his role as Smash in the tag team Demolition. He adopts various ring names over the course of his career. The Repo Man is the one I always remember. Then there's Blacktop Bully. Darso also competed in prominent wrestling promotions like the Jim Crockett Promotions, the World Wrestling Federation, the World Championship Wrestling during the 80s and 1990s. In 83, he debuts in Hawaii as Czar Mongo, and briefly in New Zealand, where he's moved around a bit more. He ends up in Georgia Championship World Wrestling under the name Man Mountain Darso. Later that year, he joins the Mid-South Wrestling as Crusher Darso, portraying an American who sympathized with the Soviet Union. And then he teams up with this guy named Nikolai Volkov, and they adopt the ring name Crusher Khrushchev. And he becomes an inaugural Mid-South television champion by defeating a guy named Terry Taylor. In 1984, Darso joins the Jim Crockett Promotions as part of a National Wrestling Alliance, and he's awarded a share of the NWA World Six-Man Tag Team Championship along with Nikita Koloff. Again, we'll get to Nikita, but another Robbinsdale guy. And they part ways after a while. Then Darso gets into this thing called the Rock and Roll Express with Ricky Morton and Robert Gibson and the Road Warriors. Darso joins the WWF in 1987 and becomes part of a tag team, Demolition Smash, alongside Axe Bill Eadie. The team was known for face paint, black attire, and aggressive style. Demolition just achieved all sorts of significant success, winning the WWF Tag Team Championship three times and holding the title record for 478 days. That was the first time. They feuded with other prominent teams like the Powers of Pain, the Warlord, the Barbarian, Bret Hart, and Jim Neidhart, the Rockers, Shawn Michaels, and Marty Jannetty. In the early 1990s, with the addition of Crush, or Brian Adams, they turned Demolition into a trio, but the group's popularity began to wane, leading to their eventual disbandment in 1991. Then Darso, repackages himself as the Repo Man, a sneaky, villainous character who repossesses items from other wrestlers. So he's always engaged in feuds with the British Bulldog and Randy Savage. And despite the character's prominence on television, people just loved it. The Repo Man, he'd go out and, repossess one of the other wrestlers' cars, and they'd come into the ring and wave the keys at him. So lots of fun. And he left the WWF in 1993. And following the WWF tenure, he competes for some independent wrestling organizations. But then he goes to the WCW in 1997, initially reprising his Blacktop Bully persona. Then he becomes a new character, Mr. Hole in One. In this one, Darso is a villainous golfer. So despite all of his great characters, it just doesn't lead. He doesn't get a championship. And so Darso leaves the WCW in 1999, and he returns to the independent wrestling scene. Occasionally, he'll show up again, reprising Smash, sometimes even with his Demolition partner, Axe. Throughout his career, he achieved a few championships, the WWF World Tag Team Championship, the NWA World Tag Team Championship, and the NWA United States Tag Team Championship. And you got to have a championship if you're going to be a wrestler, at least one. So Darso might not have as many accolades as some of our Robbinsdale wrestlers, but he had such a great TV personality, and Repo Man was such a unique character. Smash was fun too, with the goofy makeup and sticking out his tongue all the time, but I love the Repo Man. And that brings me to another one of his partners, which was Nikita Koloff. And so this guy was better known in Robbinsdale as Nelson Scott Simpson. And he grows up in Robbinsdale, goes to high school here, and he's on the football team, a defensive lineman, and a wide receiver. And in 1977, Koloff plays college football for Golden Valley Lutheran College alongside a few other wrestler notables who later become Animal of the Road Warriors. Despite suffering injuries that hindered his football career, he could still wrestle. He debuts in professional wrestling in the name Nikita Koloff. And of course, he always talks in a Russian accent. He is introduced as the nephew of Ivan Koloff, Barry Darso's nephew. Here's Nikita. He's got a great ending move. His finishing move is the Russian sickle. So it's kind of a clothesline. And Koloff's early career is marked by a series of high-profile feuds with Magnum TA, which culminated in, a best-of-seven series with the NWA United States Heavyweight Championship. So he's got an intense rivalry with a guy named Magnum TA, who is remembered as one of the most compelling storylines of the era. In 1986, Koloff's character underwent a significant transformation. And then following Magnum TA's career-ending car accident, he turns into from a villain to a hero, aligning himself with Dusty Rhodes and engaging in a heated feud. And this one's called the Four Horsemen. So it's a dominant wrestling faction, and it's led by Ric Flair. And this period really showcased Koloff's his versatility as a wrestler. After a brief hiatus, Koloff returns to wrestling in 1991 with the World Championship Wrestling, the WCW, and he resumes his rivalry with Lex Luger, which is a great name, Lex Luger. Not Lex Luthor, but you know he's evil. And so he participates in all sorts of high-profile matches there, and there's a notable feud with Sting. Again, not the rock star Sting, the wrestler Sting. And so Koloff's tenure with the WCW is marked by his continued popularity and his ability to adapt to an ever-evolving wrestling style. Koloff retires in 1992, and he leaves behind a legacy that's characterized by in-ring performances and compelling character work. His portrayal of a Russian villain during, the politically charged time period when it was just kind of added a layer of realism to his character, making him one of the most recognizable figures in wrestling history. I mean, he would come out with the Russian hat on, a red cape or something, even a Russian military uniform, all sorts of goofy get-ups for that. And he had lots of championships, NWA World Television Championship one time, the NWA National Heavyweight Championship, NWA World Six-Man Tag Team Championship four times, the UWF World Television Championship, and a few other accolades came his way. And Koloff legally changed his name to Nikita Koloff in 1988, just fully embracing that wrestling persona. So after his career, after he retired, Koloff became a devout Christian and is involved in all sorts of ministry work, serving as a representative for the Fellowship of the Sword, a religious organization. Beyond wrestling, Koloff has authored a few books, Breaking the Chains and Wrestling with Success, Developing a Championship Mentality. So they're all co-written with this guy named Jeffrey Gittimore. Anybody who watched wrestling ran into this guy in the 1980s because he was just unavoidable and loved his outfits. They always had CCCP somewhere on them too. He's also a great resource for anybody who's interested in the history of wrestling. He's still out there and doing interviews and talking about his days. And then we get to Deborah Masilli, and I hope I'm saying that name right. Think I got it, though, but she's better known as Medusa. And she attended Robbinsdale High School in 1979 after stints as a model, beauty pageant contestant, a nursing home worker, and a jazz dancer. She eventually, again, is trained by Eddie Sharkey and debuted in 1984 in the independent wrestling circuit before joining the AWA in 1986 as Medusa Masilli. And she feuded with Sherry Martel, again, Rick Martel, Sherry Martel, won the AWA World Championship Wrestling in 1987. And the same year, she gets into a management agreement with Kurt Hennig and starts this thing called the Diamond Dallas Pages Stable, the Diamond Exchange. She becomes the first woman to win Pro Wrestling Illustrated's Rookie of the Year. In 1989, Mycelli broke new ground by signing a contract with All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling, the first non-Japanese wrestler to do so. And there she trained in Japanese wrestling, kickboxing, and a few Thai martial arts. She held the IWA women's title. In 1991, she was in the WCW managing Rick Rude as part of Paul E. Dangerously's Dangerous Alliance. 2 years later, the WWF received its women's division and signed her as Alundra Blaze. She became a three-time WWF Women's Champion. In 1995, she returns to the WCW, and when she does, she famously tosses the WWF belt into the trash can. She later won a WCW Cruiserweight Championship, the first and only woman to do so before retiring in 2001. During the beginning of her wrestling career, she also worked as a part-time nurse, and she's since gone on to monster truck driving.
Thanks for listening. I'm Crystal Boyd. Robbinsdale Revisited is brought to you by the Robbinsdale Historical Society. Our little history museum is located at 4915 42nd Avenue North in the heart of Robbinsdale. We're open Fridays and Saturdays from 10 to 3. You can also visit us online at robbinsdale.org. You found this episode, so you know where to find the next one.
Bicycle into the city every Saturday to see our friends. Back home, sitting hand in hand, when the evening ends, when the evening ends, when the evening ends, in Robbinsdale, in Robbinsdale. Ooh.
Our theme music is provided by Gabe Barnett and The Rounders.